Support for this segment and the following message provided by Freak Out and Carry On, a new podcast about politics through the lens of history. Hosted by journalist Ron Suskind and historian Heather Cox Richardson. Available wherever you get podcasts and on the WBUR Listen app.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mark Twain, at the height of his fame, had made a fortune, married a fortune, lost a fortune. In 1895, he was deep in debt, 59, and up against the wall. To save himself, his house, his family, he went on a round-the-world stand-up comedy tour. What that meant was steamships, rickshaws, elephants. This hour, On Point, the amazing story of Mark Twain on the road and in trouble. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you picture Mark Twain, global comedian, in 1895, 96, everywhere? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Richard Zacks. His new book is Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round-the-world comedy tour. Richard Zacks, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
I read a lot, and this is a terrific book. This is just an amazing story, and you tell it so well. It's not, you have an unfair advantage. You've got a whole lot of Mark Twain in here.
Oh, nevertheless. I took it. Absolutely.
Wow, just fantastic. Place us in 1895. I mean, it's just unbelievable at the beginning of your story. Mark Twain, after all of his success, all of his literary triumphs, after Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn and so many more, and he's married a very wealthy, what, heiress to a coal fortune.
Right.
He's got his mansion up in Hartford, Connecticut, that he cannot afford to live in because it takes seven servants to run it, and he can't afford it. Paint the picture of the situation Mark Twain was in 1895 at age, what, 59?
59. It's almost uncanny. It's almost impossible to imagine how bad an investor he was. He just had this moonshot enthusiasm and this absolutely no patience for details, which, as anyone who's invested in Wall Street knows, that's a terrible combination.
Yes.
And he loved new technologies and startups, and he couldn't resist taking the big chance. And so Mark Twain could have just lived – he basically lived off his wife's fortune in the house, and he could have just had his royalties as a, you know, extra money for whatever he needed.
Yeah.
But no.
Cigars.
Cigars. He wanted to be fabulously wealthy. Like Carnegie said this line, "Man will do many things to get himself loved. He will do all things to get himself envied." And I think that summed it up. He just wanted so badly to have this huge fortune, but – you know, he was an inventor himself. I don't know how much the listeners know about that, but he invented, for instance, clamps to keep covers on the bed for little kids. He invented a history game. His only invention that did well was a self-pasting notebook that had dried strips of glue that you wet, and then you put in your newspaper clips and your photographs. he just couldn't stop trying to go for this massive home run investment. And so the first thing he did was – he was mad about his royalties for his books because his first book was a huge bestseller. Most people don't realize in 1895 he was identified as the author of Innocents Abroad.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he.
This is from his first round the world trip in 1869 or something, 1867,
right.
I guess.
Exactly. It was an earlier trip, and he was a humorist, and he was this humor, you know, comic travel writer, and it's unbelievable funny. I mean, it's just stuff like, you know, he finds out what the Arab boatmen were charging to cross the Sea of Galilee, and he writes, "Now I know why Jesus learned to walk on water."
You know, too damn expensive.
It's so irreverent, and it was a huge hit, and he gave talks from it, and his whole career just started to steamroll. But he only was getting a 5% royalty from his first publisher, which is the norm then was 10. Some people got 15. So he was always bitter right from the start that he had had this huge bestseller and hadn't gotten paid properly. So, you know, cut to the 1880s, he starts his own publishing company. He's going to pay himself a 90% net profit. It just was
– yeah,
it was
right,
like
that'll
gonna
work.
Be, right. It was going to be his revenge. And luckily for him, his first book that he published that wasn't his own was the biggest bestseller of the 19th century.
You're
it was Ulysses S. Grant.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so you'd think that after doing Ulysses Grant memoirs and having this huge success, but he had given Grant to lure him there 70% of net profit, which only left Twain's company 30%. So again, even though it seemed like he was an unbelievable publisher right off the bat, he didn't really make that much money on it.
On top of that, he invested in this fancy printing press that just couldn't get the job done competitively at all. He ended up saying, and I love this line, I mean, he couldn't resist speculating, as you say, with kind of wild investments. They did not pan out for him, and he ultimately wrote, "There are two times in a man's life when he should not speculate, that is, financial speculation or risky investment. And the two times are," he said, "when he can't afford it, and when he can," in all circumstances.
You know what I love about his lines? Yeah. They come from experience. Yeah. You know, they're not just, you know, I mean, I think that's why Louis C.K. is funny. They come from someplace deep and that affect all of us. And he had the worst traits and the best traits of any human I've ever written about or studied.
Stood 5 feet, 8.5 inches tall, weighed 145 pounds, size 7 shoe. Do you have your book there, Richard
Sacks?
Yeah, I do. I wish you'd turn to page 3. At the bottom, there's a nice paragraph that starts with Samuel L. Clemens, of course, the actual name of Mark Twain. I just wish you'd read that paragraph where you've got his daily hot scotch and the rest. Would you mind?
Sure, sure. Samuel L. Clemens, the living, breathing man who sometimes wrote and performed as Mark Twain, was a wonderful hodgepodge of uplifting sentiment and bad habits, of flash mood swings from temper tantrums to jokes, a fellow of stunning irreverence and of conventional yearnings for praise and wealth. He raced to judgment and often rued it. He avoided curse words in deference to his wife, but created a spectacular genre of vitriol. He smoked 2 dozen cigars a day. He drank a hot scotch most nights. He demonized his enemies and former business partners. He haloed only his closest friends and helpers. He embodied so many contradictory traits in such ample helpings: envy, generosity, suspiciousness, gullibility, loyalty, paranoia, arrogance, insecurity, that no one, not even he, could predict his moods.
Tell us about that desperate strait. And we're going to go to this Round the World tour because it is amazing. I mean, we go all over the place. You're in New Zealand and Australia and India and up in the Himalayas. You've got an amazing passage on that in Africa and on and on. But tell us about those days when he had what left his beautiful big house in Hartford because he couldn't afford to live there. He lived was living abroad for some time, but he was looking for anybody to loan him some money. He was in desperate need of money. Who'd he go to? What did they say?
He went to his friends in Hartford, and they all said no. And he was very angry about it. And then through a friend of a friend, his doctor, he met H.H. Rogers, who was probably one of the 10 or 15 wealthiest Americans, who was a top man at Standard Oil with Rockefeller. And H.H. Rogers was a huge fan of Twain's books. And he basically took on the job of being Twain's financial advisor. But what's really kind of funny is that Rogers was so rich, he could have paid off Twain's debts and not even notice that he'd written the check. But Twain's wife, Olivia, being sort of a provincial aristocrat heiress from Elmira, New York, refused to let Twain accept the money. So Twain had to go on this round-the-world speaking tour to pay off his debts himself. And it's kind of fascinating because, you know, in politics right now, we have a candidate with some bankruptcy, and you can take advantage of the perfectly legal loopholes and pay 50 cents on the dollar, or you can do what Mark Twain did, which is pay 100 cents on the dollar and almost kill yourself going around the world doing the tour.
You make a list of the days of travel, days of sickness, numbers of performances, and it's quite impressive on this long tour that was, Australia, New Zealand, India, Sri Lanka, South Africa, Britain, on and on.
Right. 122 lectures in 71 different cities, and he would be sick 50 days out of the round-the-world trip.
And how many days sailing do you recall offhand? It was 98 nights at sea, you're right. That's right.
Right.
Almost 50 days ill from coughs, colds, boils, stomach illness. He would travel, you write, by rail, rickshaw, mule-drawn carriage, man-toted palanquin and elephant. And his sightseeing boat would veer near floating corpses in the Ganges, and Zulus would do war dances for him. Did he relish all this, or was he like, "Get me off the tour"?
He was so grouchy in the beginning because he hadn't gotten a chance to prepare. We didn't even mention that he had a boil on his thigh the size of, like they say, a turkey egg. Oh. So he couldn't get out of bed for 45 days before he left. And one of his creditors sued him, and he had to limp into court and defend himself from a $5,000 lawsuit, which is like $150,000 today. And he wanted to fight it. H.H. Rogers wanted to fight it, but his wife wanted to pay it off. So he was in just the foulest mood. But this miraculous thing happened as he traveled. It sounds corny, but the laughter of the audiences and the love and admiration just started to heal him on some level.
We're going
to
look,
and it's great.
We're going to look at those performances and that interaction, the amazing exotic scenes in which he found himself. But just how dark was his mood? Here he was talking about the inventor James Page, who had put together what the printing press that did not pan out.
18,000 parts,
right? And he said, "He and I." This is Mark Twain talking about the inventor he was invested in. "He and I always meet on effusively affectionate terms. And yet he knows perfectly well that if I had his nuts in a steel trap, I would shut out all human succor and watch that trap till he died." That is a dark mood, Richard.
That is a dark mood. He was so angry. I mean, you think about it. He was 60. He was starting to write. He'd written Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. And he felt a little ashamed of having to do stand-up comedy. I mean, he's like the classic comic who wants to be the literary lion. He felt it demeaned him a little. He said, "Once an audience sees you stand on your head, they expect you to remain in that position." And he didn't want to do it. So, yeah, that's very dark. And I love some of his lines about Page. He says, you know, Page could he's such a talker, he could persuade a fish to come out and take a walk with him. and it was always one little widget away from being perfected. 18,000 parts. The man worked
all.
On it 20
that's
years.
That's all. And yet he was in trouble, Mark Twain writing, "I have never felt so desperate in my life, for I haven't got a penny to my name, and Mrs. Clemens hasn't enough laid up with her brother Charles Langdon to keep us 2 months. I do not sleep these nights for visions of the poorhouse. Everything does look blue, so dismally blue." And off he would go around the world on a global stand-up comedy tour. Richard Zacks writes about that tour, and we're going to dive straight into it in his new book, Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round the world comedy tour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about Mark Twain's desperate last ditch comeback comedy tour in 1895-96, where the master American humorist dug himself out of a deep hole of debt with a worldwide stand-up routine. Richard Zacks writes it all up in his new book, Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round-the-world comedy tour. He's written about Teddy Roosevelt. He's written about Thomas Jefferson. But this time, it's Twain, 59, 60 years old, in deep, deep trouble and traveling the world, making them laugh with his very deadpan humor. We'll look at that as well. You can join us this hour. Can you see Mark Twain twitching his mustache for laughs in India and telling Tom Sawyer stories after a visit to the Taj Mahal? Can you picture the global journey by rail, by rickshaw, steamer, mule-drawn carriage, elephant? We do not have the sound of his voice. Hal Holbrook, famous for his readings, his performance of Mark Twain. Here he was. Can't tell you if he had this on his trail or not. Maybe Richard Zacks can, but he's reading here from Twain's 1903 essay, The Damned Human Race.
"Man is the reasoning animal. Such is the claim. Though I do think that's open to dispute. I've been studying this reasoning animal for years now, and I find the results humiliating."
Hal Holbrook as Mark Twain. Okay, Richard Zacks, here we are. He's in deep trouble. He says he feels like he is living a lingering suicide with all his financial woes. And he's going to set out. How does he arrange this tour in 1895-96, and how does he start out?
Well, there's a lecture agent, a Major Pond, and they discuss where he'll go. And basically, he'd want to do 9 practice runs in New York City. But because he was sick, he only got to do 2, and one of them totally bombed. And the other one was a bunch of prisoners in Elmira Reformatory, so that didn't really count. Yeah. They actually got brownie points if they laughed. They would get shortened sentences for good behavior.
That's an incentive.
I know. So Twain went out very insecure, and basically they worked out that the U.S. part of the trip, I mean, they didn't tell anyone this, but it'd be kind of a dry run for the world. So he'd practice in about 20 cities across the United States, and he started in Cleveland, and you just can't make this up. He starts in Cleveland. He's always very nervous and a little crabby in the beginning. And they didn't tell him, but there was going to be a honeymoon couple playing flute and violin for 45 minutes before they let him go on.
Okay.
And they kept clapping.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they clapped them to encores. And then they didn't tell him that it was a benefit for the newsboys, and there'd be 500 newsboys sitting behind him on the stage with no chaperone. So he was just – and then a dog got loose. I mean, it couldn't get any worse. And he botched his opening. He tried to do an opening about morals and crimes, and it didn't really work. And he finally just gave up towards the end of the – so he was pretty discouraged. But fortunately, you know, day after day, performance, it got way better. And then he made some very key decisions that really helped him.
Describe roughly the course of his traversing of the globe.
Oh, basically, he went west from New York City, and part of the reason he left New York is he was liable to lawsuits inside the state of New York because that's where his bankruptcy was. So he actually was leaving the state in order not to be served, legal papers and wind up in court.
He went on the run, and he was worried he might even lose the rights to Huckleberry Finn. I mean, we should be fair.
He might have.
Yeah.
He very well might have.
It was close. But the country was still coming out of this panic of 1893, stock market crash, more than 16,000 businesses failed to remind us, more than 2.5 million men unemployed. So it had been a rough economic time.
Right. And he might have – his company might have endured it if it hadn't been. I don't think – nothing was going to help the Page typesetter. That was dead. But he might have survived. And what's so interesting is the country was obsessed with the unemployment and the bad news. And so the idea of a humorist paying all his debts when some of the richest men in America were I use the word hiding behind bankruptcy laws, mm-hmm. whatever word you want to use. I find this really interesting. H.H. Rogers advised him to pay only 10 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar. Mm-hmm. And Livy was adamant. And Twain waited. And Livy said, your reputation is more valuable than anything. And it seemed almost like a hokey line at the time, mm-hmm. but it turned out she was 100% right, because when he came back after paying everything off, every single article started with him that he paid off his debts. And the nation was so ready to buy his books and buy his complete edition, they just couldn't believe he had done that in this horrible economic times.
Listen to the wife. Livy had it right. I want to get on that trip west from Cleveland, but we've got callers for you, Richard Zacks. The new book is Chasing the Last Laugh. It is terrific. Bethany in West Hartford, Connecticut, not so far from Twain's great house there, Samuel Clemens' great house. Bethany, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I just wanted to say Twain was a genius, and the thing that strikes me is that he's so honest. We all feel exactly the same way, the same dark thoughts, but we're not brave enough to articulate them. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk about that honesty. And then I also was thinking, we would all probably be comedians if we opened up about what was going on in our brains on a daily basis.
Sorry?
Oh, no, I love it, Bethany. Yes, please, Richard.
I completely agree with you, and I think it's the most profound kind of honesty. He goes so deep inside himself. I'm looking at a couple of lines that he wrote. Few of us can stand prosperity. Another man's, I mean. I mean, you know, we think that. We want to be happy for our friend, but there's nothing worse than to walk sort of the hill of wealth and find that your friend already owns a mansion on top. And I mean, he says these things. There are several good protections against temptation, but the surest is cowardice. I mean, Bethany, you're absolutely right. He goes but I think what makes it work so well, he really was a deeply flawed, with all due respect to him, deeply flawed man. He was so jealous at times, and he was vengeful, and he was self-indulgent, and then he was absolutely generous and wonderful, and you know, so he had it all. He had such extremes in him. That's where I think the humor comes from.
And yet he hung in there. This is from the Ken Burns documentary, 2002, Mark Twain, Twain scholar Jocelyn Chadwick talking about how he would come back from serious setbacks.
There are those times when he's writing his letters and in his autobiography that you just think, Sam, you can just go no further. This is it. This is the most devastating blow you could have had. You feel as though he's given up on God, life, the whole bit, and then he comes through, he rallies.
He was a rallier. Take us west from Cleveland and give us a sense of the course that this great world tour took, Richard.
Well, he basically went north. He liked to travel by boat, so he went over the Great Lakes when he could, and then he winds up in Minneapolis, and that's where he made the decision. His wife told him, you know, you're trying so hard to make everyone laugh. Give them a chance to catch their breath. Mm. Why don't you try using Huck, the story of Huck on the raft with the slave Jim, where Huck has to probe his conscience whether or not he turns in a runaway slave.
Yeah.
And Mark Twain was very skeptical of whether that story would work. And right in the middle of six comedy bits, but he followed Livy's advice. And it turned out to be far and away the most popular item in his repertoire.
He's in Minneapolis and then west and west and west. Keep us going.
Yeah, okay. So he's up in the mountains. He goes to Butte. He goes to Helena. He goes... He takes the train over the mountains that escape my memory, and he winds up in Spokane. Mm-hmm. And then he gets to the West Coast, and he does Portland. And Portland is his biggest event. And he – actually, I should just look at this list of the places that he went to. He went to Crookston, Minnesota, Crookston, Montana, Great Falls, Montana, Butte, Anaconda, Helena, Missoula, Spokane, Seattle, yeah. Portland, Olympia, Tacoma, Seattle, Fairhaven, Vancouver. He just keeps heading west, and he's performing in small places because what we forget is there was no air conditioning back then.
Yeah.
So you really couldn't fill in a hot place. You really couldn't. So he actually had his lecture agent try to get him mountains and water places so it would be a little cooler. And a lot of these were just 400-seat. You know, theaters. And he was charging a dollar a head when he could get it, sometimes just 50 cents for general admission. And this trip west didn't really make him that much money, but it got him enough money. The reason it didn't make him that much money is he kept staying in the best hotel in town. Mm-hmm. And back then, performers had to pay their own expenses. And he felt like he had married an heiress, even if she was a coal heiress from Elmira, and mm-hmm. she was used to the finest things in life. So he would book them into these places that cost two and three times what the next hotel cost. And that's just how he did it, and it dug into his chance for profits. But this, again, is Mark Twain's contradictory nature. It's wonderful.
You got wonderful photographs in here of him at a tar paper shack of a Norwegian shanty town in Great Falls, Montana. I mean, he got out among the people. And then it's off into the wild blue yonder. I mean, he is all over the world. In those days, how did one arrange a global comedy tour? I mean, you can't just send somebody an email or a text.
No, that was hard. That part was actually hard. He wrote to someone, and again, he was a good promoter, self-promoter. So he wrote to someone named R.S. Smythe, who was probably the leading English language lecture agent for the Australia and India and that whole mm-hmm. area. And he just wrote him a letter. And while his letter was going there, Smythe's letter was arriving to Twain. So Twain self-promoted by writing an essay on telepathy, how mental telepathy had caused Smythe to write to him. There was a different model back then. The lecture agent got 50% of the ticket sales, and that's after the arena got something like 25%. So the amounts that Twain would clear kept you know, being reduced and reduced. But so Smythe basically set the whole thing up. They just agreed, yes, I'll do it. Here's when I arrive. And Smythe just took him here and there, and that's how it worked.
Take us abroad, then. How did he make the leap?
Well, he takes this ocean liner type ship from Victoria, British Columbia, and what had happened? The ship had accidentally grounded itself, and not accidentally. The captain had accidentally grounded it, and it turned out that the damage was pretty bad. The plates on the bottom, and so here's Livy and Clara going off to sea. They split their family up. His wife is traveling with him, and his middle daughter. But his oldest daughter, Susie, and his youngest daughter, Jean, stayed back in Elmira with Aunt Sue. So this is pretty dramatic. That Clemens family was a very tight-knit family, and to split up like that was very traumatic. And Twain deeply blamed himself for breaking the family up to take this trip. And so three of them are getting on a boat that's already been in a bad accident that's a couple weeks delayed.
SS Warimu.
And they sail to Hawaii. And Twain is so excited because I don't know how many people realize, but Twain's first break as a writer, I mean, he'd gone to almost 30 with just silver miner and riverboat pilot. And he was pretty, you know, he wasn't all that successful at things. Mm-hmm. And then he goes and starts writing these travel pieces from what was then called the Sandwich Islands, which would become Hawaii. And they include cannibal jokes and some other silly stuff, but it pretty much launched his career, because when he won, the pieces were really popular. Then he came back and did basically a stand-up routine. I mean, at one point during a cannibal joke, he'd go and, "Is there anyone have a baby out here in the audience? Can I just borrow a baby for a second? You know, do this cannibal thing." He gets to Hawaii, and cholera has broken out a couple days before he arrives. And he was so disappointed, because he had been there the first time as a young, unknown reporter, and now he was coming back as the most famous humorist in the English language, and he really wanted that moment, and it was just torture. The boat's bobbing out there, you know, supplies are being offloaded.
Cannot
and Twain
go ashore.
Can't land.
And
so
he needs an audience. He needs to perform. He needs to make money. Richard Zack's new book is Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round-the-world comedy tour. On he goes, Australia, New Zealand, India. Take us to some of the most interesting places that he performed and the kind of responses he got.
Well, in Sydney and in Melbourne, he sold it out like crazy. And that was the turning point in his trip, because he didn't know how he'd be received by a British audience. It's a different sense of humor, different sensibilities, and they absolutely loved him, and he really fed off of it. They added extra – I mean, and these houses could hold 3,000 people, so he was making serious money, and they added extra dates. And but, you know, he – things – it's a little hard sometimes to get his performances to explain them to a modern audience. He did an incredibly silly poem about Australia, but what it was he knew how bad it was, so he purposely – he explained how he could never find a rhyme. If you get the meaning right, you can't find the rhyme. If you get the rhyme right, you can't find the meaning. And he just did this patter. He basically called Australia Land of the Ornithorhynchos, which is a duck-billed platypus.
Yes.
I mean, who gets up, you know, it's like coming to America and, you know, rat-tailed beaver, otter, I don't know, something. You know, he just – and he had the nerve to do it. I mean, we haven't really talked about his performance style, but he
Tell
did
us.
It in debt. So he spoke really slowly. He had a little bit of a twang, you know, and he had the nerve to pause, long pauses, and he sometimes put his head on his hand, and he had a little twinkle in his eyes, and he never smiled. And he did this in conversation with other people too. So a lot of times people would think he was done speaking and jump in, and then he'd finish his sentence. And it's just – when you read these and you kind of get mesmerized into a Twain moment, you can hear it. And the speeches only work that way. If you don't do them slowly, if you don't honor the pauses, you can't imagine why this man was considered funny. But if you do, the payoff's great.
How did it go down in Australia, in New Zealand? This was very American-centric humor. How did they receive that?
Amazingly, they absolutely loved him. They clapped him to all kinds of people. Were, you know, the usual, the heart attacks, the breathlessness, he was just incredibly popular. He was invited to all kinds of different homes of the local aristocrats. In New Zealand, he toured Maori settlements. He was just very well received. He did have some problems when he first arrived. He made the mistake of making some comments about politics, and he badmouthed a fellow American author who's mostly forgotten today, Bret Hart. He badmouthed Bret Hart and got a whole stampede against him of some journalists. And then Livy basically told – and this is kind of interesting about Mark Twain. Livy told him, you know, you're traveling to make money. You're not traveling to make political speeches. You know, save those for later. And Twain actually muzzled himself for most of the rest of the trip. He didn't make comments on imperialism, colonialism, a lot of things that appalled him, you know, the killing off the indigenous peoples. But boy, he took them out in his travel book later. He put everything he couldn't say in person because he was selling tickets. He saved it all for later.
The Equator book.
Following the Equator.
Following the Equator. Richard Zacks is writing about his own book, about Mark Twain, on that great stand-up comedy tour of the world. We've got him to Australia and New Zealand. We'll get him to India and Africa and beyond when we return. The book is Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round-the-world comedy tour. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking Mark Twain on the road. This is On Point. We'll be right back. talking this hour about Mark Twain's desperate last-ditch comeback comedy tour in 1896, where the master American humorist dug himself out of a deep hole of debt with a worldwide stand-up routine. It was a desperate journey right around the planet. Richard Zacks writes it all up in a wonderful new book. It is Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round-the-world comedy tour. He joins us today from New York. You can join us as well. Why do you think his humor, Mark Twain's, would have played so globally so long before our globalization? And do you admire the work ethic that he went out and did what it took to pay his debts, clear his name? Can you still feel the Twain magic across the century plus since then? This is just a terrific book. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Hal Holbrook, famous for channeling Mark Twain. Here's a little bit where he just talked about what lay within Mark Twain's big persona and his channeling of America.
We're God's country. We're a big success. And he had that about him. He was not hiding his light under a bushel. At the same time, underneath there, you smell suffering.
You smell the suffering, and it was acute financial suffering at this time. Ron Powers, the writer in Ken Burns' documentary, Mark Twain, talked about Twain's gift for drawing in an audience performance.
He was an unintentional genius of the stage. He had this shambling gait, and he had this bewildering drawl. His mother called it Sammy's long talk. Some people thought he was drunk when he wandered out on stage and kind of mumbled about like this. But as the act went on, as the lecture went on, they began to see that the pauses were the great formulations. The pauses were the great preludes to the cascade of humor.
Richard Zacks makes that abundantly clear in his new book, Chasing the Last Laugh. Take us there to him on stage. I mean, we've been in Australia, New Zealand. Take us on into, I mean, the British Empire helped, I guess, the globalization path in those days. Take us into India, where he performed there, and then up into the Himalaya, where you describe this amazing down-the-mountain railway ride that he took with the
right.
family.
I would think, I mean, first off, you have to hear that despite, you might think that he was a bit grouchy, this was a lot of traveling, he adored India. It's uncanny to picture the most American of writers being so fascinated by the most foreign of places. He couldn't get over the costumes, the near nudity, the snake charmers, the cows in the street. He just was like a kid. His daughter writes in her memoir, she had never seen her father so enthusiastic about India. And he said it was the one place, and he had been to England, France, he'd been everywhere, Switzerland, Italy, the one place that he would like to visit again in his whole life beside heaven. You know, that just...
I understand it. Well, you've got these wonderful photographs of, you know, the streets full of cows and the snake charmers, as you say, the guy, you know, in a loincloth on a bed of nails in the street, and Twain swooning for all that.
He was jealous that the guy could lay on a bed of nails and make money.
who came out for those India performances?
Well, mostly, you know, the audience was about 3/4, 4/5 British, Caucasian. But he did get some local Indian attention. What he liked about India, too, was that he wasn't recognized in the streets. Mm-hmm. It's the contradiction. He had – that hair was not normal. That was an unusual haircut to have so
that
much
big, wild head of hair, yeah.
Right, and the mustache, too. So he claims to not want to be recognized, and then, of course, he wants to be recognized. But in India, I have to tell you about the greatest perk any celebrity had ever gotten. I still can't get over they did this for him. He goes up to Darjeeling, which is 6,000-7,000 feet, you know, elevation. It's fairly close to Mount Everest. Mm-hmm. And this is the unbelievable Himalayan mountains. And when he gets ready to leave after his performance, the British railway authorities allow him to use 30 miles of track as a personal roller coaster. He gets a 6-seater car. And he, his wife, and his daughter, and an British engineer get in, and they just get to go down the mountain. And it's steep, and there's 1,000-foot drops. There are 4 corkscrew turns where it turns back on itself, and 4 places it's so steep they have to reverse direction zigzag. And so Twain, and you just have to picture Livy, because Livy is a delicate woman. Livy supposedly couldn't walk 100 yards, and Twain just so enjoyed taking her on that down that mountain on a roll, like a lot of husbands, I suspect. taking their wives on something that's pretty dangerous. And Twain even said that, you know, we had a safety system. The British sent another little car ahead of us, and if that flipped the tracks and went down, we'd just send for another little car.
Livy, the wife, alongside him, and down they would go, Twain wrote, corkscrewing in and out of crags and precipices, down, down, forever down, and then riding. I mean, they got this thing, you remind, halfway down, they stopped at for tea at a mountainside chalet. They saw a Tibetan dance play. Then they went on, and Twain writes, for rousing, tingling, rapturous pleasure, there is no holiday trip that approaches the bird flight down the Himalayas in a hand car. It has no fault, no blemish. Richard Zaks is with us. His new book is Chasing the Last Laugh. Chris is calling from Westwood, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. You and I shared a office building over in Newtonville many years ago.
Oh,
a different
wonderful
life for
yeah,
both
wonderful
of us.
Yeah.
But when I heard your introduction to today's show, I thought of a Twain quote that I really love. And interestingly enough, ironically, it's not funny at all. It's the only quote of his that I know that's not funny. But I wanted to read it and then ask Richard a question. I'm sure he's familiar
okay
with it. The quote is, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And many of our people need it sorely on those accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime. And my question is, I mean, I'm kind of making the assumption, but Richard, maybe you can confirm it, that quote came from either the book or that tour that you guys are referring to today on the show.
Travel is the antidote to racism and bigotry. Richard?
You know, I'm not sure that it is from Following the Equator. If it is, I didn't highlight it to pull out for my book. You know, he wrote five or six travel books. He wrote Innocence Abroad, Roughing It, Tramp Abroad. So it easily could be from one of the other ones. But the point's really well taken. It absolutely expanded his mind, especially India. He could not – or tattoos. He wrote – after 15 minutes, he started to not be able to look at a face without tattoos, without being disappointed when he was in New Zealand and the Maori warriors were around. It completely, and then the religions that he noticed and the monkeys at the temple, it just completely expanded his mind on so many different levels. But I don't think it's from Following the Equator, but I could be wrong.
You've read a lot of his letters. Does this observation stand up in his private correspondence? I mean, this was an era of casual racism. Was Twain beyond that or of that, within that?
Twain was wonderful on this topic. He was the most open-minded, generous person on this. He put an African-American student through law school. He was the one who'd sit on the back steps and talk to whoever the cook was. He just someone could say, you know, he sort of was disappointed in the whole human race. He didn't single out any single race. But no, he was fantastic on this topic, and he very generous.
Give us a sense
and
of
he,
that.
He looked He loved the Indian servants. He devotes like 20 pages to the servants that he had in India and clearly talked to them a lot, knew all about their lives. And
you describe all the ways in which he traveled, and I was trying to tease out, you know, what was just for a good story and what was not. I mean, he told up in Darjeeling, he said if he hadn't been able to see the mountains, he would have had to lie and say that he did. But he was on elephant, he was in rickshaw, he was on palanquin. Where, what, why?
Right. Well, he also said about George Washington, you know, not the whole bit about I cannot tell a lie. Twain basically said that's a fatal defect. I wouldn't advertise that. So Twain didn't let the truth get in the way. And that's the trouble with writing about Twain is even in his own personal letters, there's basically three. At one point when I was writing this, I got really frustrated because in his autobiography that a lot of writers love to quote, he's clearly making it up or he just doesn't. He said this line, I used to remember what happened and what didn't happen, and now I can only remember what didn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are three different versions, and the autobiography is probably the least reliable, and that's the one that's quoted by so many people. So he just wanted – he couldn't help himself. As someone said, he had a fatal sense of the ridiculous. He had to have fun with things and rarely let the truth get in the way.
It was a 90-minute show. He had it memorized, not in the white suit that Hal Holbrook made famous, but in a black kind of evening
right
suit.
Exactly.
And what was the body of this performance? And did he do the same thing every night?
No, it's really interesting. He would do 6 to 7 vignettes each night, and he had about a repertoire of about 30 of them. But because he had to perform in the same city in consecutive nights, he needed 3 90-minute shows memorized. So he basically that's an enormous amount of work that he had to do. And these were his, I would say, his greatest hits from when he was younger and a little fresher. I mean, these were stories, I think all of us have them, our go-to stories about the time that he came into his father's office and in the dark and didn't know that a corpse had been laid out because his father was a coroner. Or the, you know, going fishing instead of going to school, or first time he bought a bucking bronco, or these are, we all have these go-to stories. And so he had a collection of them, and He would alternate the routine. He had a first night, second night, third night. They were perfected. They were excellent.
And the lines that never failed, or the dramatic pauses that never failed?
Oh, unbelievable. I mean, at the end of the one where, I mean, you had to hear the whole thing. You had to see this sort of gloomy-looking man talking in a monotone. But he builds about buying his first horse, and it turns out to be a bucking bronco. And then the horse sends him up into the sky. I saw birds I never saw before. I went over the church steeple, and when I got back down, the horse was gone.
Flat.
You know, and he pulled these off, and he was fearless with his humor. You know, that Australian poem, I just can't imagine anyone having the nerve to do a purposely bad poem like that and then explain it all seriously like they're doing literary criticism. I mean, he was very... Yeah, it's good stuff.
We're talking about the global stand-up comedy tour that Mark Twain took to save his finances, and it worked. Richard Zaks writes it all up in the new book, Chasing the Last Laugh. Sue in Springfield, Illinois. Sue, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Love your show. I originally called to not get on the air to say that I misheard that they were saying Libby, and I wanted to correct that he always called her Livy.
Oh, it is quite clear. It's Livy, as in Olivia. Yeah. Livy, yes.
Right. Right.
Yes, for Olivia. I used to be a docent at the Mark Twain House in Hartford, Connecticut. Unfortunately, he had to sell that beautiful, beautiful home because of his finances. But we had a plethora of great stories to tell about him, some true, some, of course, not true. My favorite was there was a, Hartford called it a river that ran outside the his home in Hartford, and now it's been put underground. But anyway, I can't imagine that he thought of that as a river growing up on the Mississippi. And in Missouri, he would have called that a creek. And one more thing to add, my favorite Mark Twain quote that I've shortened is, "Travel is fatal to prejudice." Thank you.
Oh, Sue, thank you so much. And of course, you would have thought it was a creek after Hannibal, Missouri and all that. I spent many happy days there as a kid. Was this working as he traveled, Richard? Was he making the money? And how did he get it back home? How did it all work before globalization in 1896?
He sent it back home by a bank wire. You know, the telegraph was working.
Telegraph was just fine. Yep.
Yeah, so they had transatlantic cables, and they were connected by loop, by loop, by loop. And so he wired money home from Australia. He basically paid off about a quarter of his debt through the speaking tour. And then the rest of it he made back mostly through his book. You know, it turned out the book was a big success following the equator.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, I guess we're running out of time, so we should say he did, it has a happy ending. He did pay this off, and then he did eventually return home absolutely triumphant in 1900 to New York to a hero's welcome for paying his debts and for writing the book. And H.H. Rogers succeeded in creating a complete edition that's a lot of people have today that basically put him, made him a wealthy man. So after all this, you know, pain and suffering, at least there was a financial happy ending.
He died about 10 years after this full trip at age 74, left an estate of $471,000 with about $15 million today. So things came back pretty well after all.
They did. And I just wanted to say about the house, it's not quite a non sequitur, but there were so many great little quirky details. I completely agree with her. He had a little balcony off his study, and he would go out and stand on it so his butler could say, "Mark Twain is not in," and not be lying. He also didn't invest in the telephone, which he had one of the first installed in the country in Hartford. He just quirky man.
And the typesetting machine, I was calling it a printing machine, but the typesetting machine, did it ever come to pass that it...
It did. Not for him. The Linotype became one of the greatest financial successes of the century, made a lot of money for other people, not for Mark Twain. And Mark Twain's... There were two of them. One got melted down in World War I to help, you know, metal for weapons or whatever. And the other one is actually in the Mark Twain house. And you just look at it and you could see – I mean, he had been a typesetter as a kid. He'd been what you called a, you know, printer's devil or whatever. And he just found it so exciting, the idea of hitting a key and having the type drop in place. But this device just never worked.
Couldn't get it going. What did he learn from this trip in following the equator, in the equator, that he hadn't from earlier trips? Did you see Twain come away with a new insight that particularly stood out to you, Richard?
Well, to be honest, it got colored so by what happened at the end that when he would have had some kind of profound insight, his daughter passed away while he was traveling, and it was just the most heartbreaking moment imaginable because he completely blamed himself for the fact that she was home. She wasn't treating herself properly medically. She believed in mental science and Livy was already on a boat going home when Twain got the telegram in England that Susie had died. So it's just one of the most horrible. So that colored everything and sent. Yeah, that was difficult.
It was not an easy trip in the end, but what an image to think of Mark Twain at that age in those circumstances, setting out around the world, making them laugh all over the place with his slow drawl and his very, very American tales.
Incredible. American superstar, American celebrity. It's just extraordinary what he did.
Circa 1896. It's a terrific book. I enjoyed it enormously, and great kudos to you for bringing all this research together and making it so vivid again. Richard Zacks, thanks. You very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great being here.
The book is Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round-the-world comedy tour. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.